You're listening to Symposium, a year-round conference in the arts, brought to you by Pipeline Artists. I am here tonight with Lane Schefter Bishop, and let me tell you, Lane and I are friends, so this is going to be like really fun, casual, chill discussion. We're going to talk all about things in the industry, adaptation, book to film, acquiring books, a cool little niche market that Lane has, and she's genius, I have to say. I'm a little upset I didn't think of it first. And there may or may not be wine in my reckless creative song.
But I love it.
I'd like to introduce you to Lane Schefter Bishop. She's a multi-award winning producer and director who's received numerous accolades for her work, including an Emmy, 6 Telly Awards, a Videographer Award, 3 Communicator Awards, a Cheryl C. Corwin Award, an Aurora Award, a Davy Award, a New York Festival Award, and DGA Fellowship Award, Episodic Television. Currently, Lane is the CEO of Vast Entertainment, and you've been the CEO of Vast for a while. And Vast is a really interesting company. It's literally the go-to book to screen company, and they've got lots of projects in development, which we can certainly touch on. One of the things that really drew me to Lane, we met at a conference in DC. I had heard someone refer to her as the book whisperer, because CNN had dubbed her the book whisperer of Hollywood, which is so fun. I would literally get a t-shirt with that on, Lane. Why don't you have a t-shirt yet?
I'm going to have to do that, clearly.
Yeah, I'll get you one. I'll make you a custom t-shirt. So with that title, how did that come about? Like, tell me about this whole little niche that you have I know about it, but share with everybody that the book to film, how you do acquire these books way before they're published.
So I decided, with some help from my husband who pushed me, to start Vast in 2008. And at that time, nobody wanted books. Like, nobody. You can say the word book in the room without them like running away. Because, you know, it was all they could do to read a 120-page script. They didn't want to read a 300 and whatever page book for anything. So I started to do books because I was a lit major before I went to USC Film School. So it kind of combined my two favorite things. Plus, I always talk about this. If you read 100 scripts, let's be honest, maybe 5 are good. And if you read 100 books, probably 50 of those would be great for a TV show or a movie. So it was just like better return for my reading hours, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's really because a lot of times, as you know, like people write a script and they just send it out. That's it. Whereas with a book, like it went through a publisher and it went through an editor and it went through an agent and it went through a publishing company, and like people had to look at it. So it ends up being usually a lot better. And I couldn't really get people excited about books back then. Everything's changed now. Thank you, God. So
what year was it that you started?
2008. This is like, you know, pre all the good stuff, pre Harry Potter and, you know, pre Hunger Games and all the things that changed everything. So I had to figure out a way to get people to want to hear about book material. So I started to create log lines, basically, because what I would do is I would go to New York 4 times a year, 5 times a year, and meet with authors' agents. And instead of saying, show me your backlist, they'd be like, what do you have coming up? What are you excited about? And they would tell me about all this cool stuff coming. And because I don't care if it's published or not. In fact, to be honest, I'd like it not to be published. It's so much easier for me to sell it if it's pre, because I call it dropping breadcrumbs. I can send things to executives, just like, even if I have the whole book, oh, here's 20 pages that just came in, lucky you, because they're never going to read the whole thing. So if I do it in little drips and drabs, I get a better chance of them actually reading stuff. But aside from that, I really felt like, you know, if you have this material and you get it beforehand, you can change the material for the buyer. That's what I did with Reboot. It was a book that, you know, was about zombies, essentially. And I'm like, too many zombie projects. Why don't we just call them reboots? and talk about how they reboot when they die. And that way I can actually sell it. And I set it up with Peter Chernin because they were reboots. They weren't zombies. So, you know, it's really nice to get early because you can adjust the material for the buyer. And also I find, you know, you can argue with me if you want, but I do find that a lot of authors are less precious about the material if it's not published yet. So yeah, they're more open to like, oh yeah, we'll change that or change that. And I never change the main thrust of what it's about and the message and all the important stuff. But you know, stuff's going to change anyway when it adapts, obviously.
Yeah.
And so it ended up being that I hate those two questions you get in every Hollywood room. How many books have sold and is it a bestseller? So when I got things early, I didn't have to hear any of those because no books have sold and not a bestseller yet, but it will be. And you know, I could sell it on, you're getting a sneak peek at some really cool stuff that no one's seen yet, you know? So that's how I did it. That's how I ended up in sort of pre-publication book land.
Mm-hmm. And when you're working with those authors and the book hasn't been published yet, do you find that they actually, I'm sure there are some who are defensive about their story, but do you find that they're almost grateful to get notes from you? Like that you're a Hollywood, I'm sorry, but I think most authors dream of having their book adapted. So if somebody who's a director, a writer themselves, somebody, a production company in Hollywood says, I'm interested in helping you develop your story, I imagine they're probably pretty happy.
I've had great experiences. And I've worked with people who've done nothing. And I've worked with, you know, Sandra Brown. So, you know, it runs the gambit. And even Sandra Brown was like, oh, yeah, you know what? That's not very visual. Let me see if I can come up with something else to for you guys. Like, it was great. It's a back and forth. You know, it's a collaboration, just like anything else in film.
Do the authors want to get involved then in the screenwriting adaptation process of it? Or do you do the adaptation?
So
do you hire a writer for that?
I strongly recommend that authors do not write their own screenplays. and it's not for lack of talent. It's because things get made based on packages, right? Mm-hmm. So you want the best package possible if you actually want it to get made. So the way you get that package is you get a A-list $300,000 a year screenwriter to write your screenplay. That's how it gets made. I'm unusual for Hollywood. I like to have the author involved in the process. I think the author and the screenwriter should talk. I think it's awesome. I've had nothing but great experiences hearing authors and screenwriters talk about material. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I'm an anomaly. I think, you know, most of Hollywood's like, oh, here's your paycheck. Go away. You know, I'm just not like that. I love having the author involved. I mean, first of all, it's their baby. And second of all, who knows it better? You know, even if I've read it 100 times, I don't know it as much as they know it. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoy having them involved and I try to keep them involved as much as I can.
What if the first time author, do you get like pushback of, you know, the industry, production companies, whatever, people getting attached, not knowing, well, would this book even be successful? Like this is a debut author? Or do you usually work with people who maybe already have a book or two out?
I like to say content is king. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, and I'll be honest too, if the book is sort of not terribly well written, I'll say to the exec, it's not like, you know, Orson Welles or anything. It's not like the most amazing book you ever read. It's a really cool idea that I think could be adapted. You know,
yeah.
I'm brutal in terms of like, I work in a very transparent way. And like, I'll say to the author, like, well, you won't be in the room with me, but I'm representing you in that room. Is there anything you want to make sure that I slam home for you? You know, that's my job is to make sure I'm representing that author because they're not in the room. So I haven't had anyone be like, oh, well, like the Duff, no one ever heard of the Duff. No one heard of Cody. She wrote it when she was 17, you know? So it didn't matter. It's like, that is the cool idea. Designated ugly fat friend. What a great idea, you know? So I've just been lucky, I guess. Content is king. If the idea is really cool, and I tend to look for sort of outside the box, left of center kind of stuff, things that are unique and different, and they don't care that much about the author. I mean, of course, it helps if they've sold a lot of books or if they're a big bestseller or what I work with Ann Perry, she has 57 million books in print. But I also work with people who've never done anything. So I honestly, it doesn't matter.
What was that first reception like when you're in New York and you're, you know, because you probably, did you go to like Thriller Fest or something? Like, where were you when you first did this? When you first said to the agents, hey, I'm not interested in your backlist. I'm actually interested in the things you haven't even done yet.
Yeah, it was fun. I went to Book Expo.
Oh, Book Expo.
And they have a room where they have all the agents. And, you know, and I had such a good time because everyone has their little list. And I'm like, yeah, shove that away. And I was like, do you have something that your authors have pitched you that you're excited about? I mean, I've had people literally, like agents, have sent me, you know, 3 one-pagers. And they're like, my author pitched me these 3 ideas. Which one do you think they should do? You know, that's so fun. And one of them, I mean, I've set up before, like, it was so, Joel Silver did it with me because I literally was like, that is such a cool idea. Do that. You know, it's kind of fun, you know, because you have so much freedom at that point because it's just the author's imagination with some really, really creative, cool ideas.
We have a lot of, we have both novelists and screenwriters and filmmakers in our circle at Pipeline. So say somebody writes screenplays, but also writes novels and they have an idea. Do you think it's better for them to write it as a book first or a screenplay first?
Such a great question. Always do the book first. Do the book first. I even recommend to screenwriters that they backtrack and do a book proposal. Find an article that your thing is loosely based on. Whatever you can do. Because right now, as opposed to when I started, books are so big. Underlying IP is just everything now. So I can go in with 2 identical projects and one of them is with a book underneath and one of them is not. And guess which one's going to sell? It's going to be the one with the book. Because they assume there's going to be an audience for that book and that's adding to their movie audience. So always good to have underlying IP, an intellectual property. And that can be an article, that can be a book, that can be a newspaper thing, that can be anything that your screenplay is based on, basically.
Do you ever feel like Hollywood is enamored with authors? Like, I mean,
now they are.
A love hate thing with them, or are they?
Now they are. For so many years, no. But now, yes, absolutely. Now everything's like based on the book by fill in the blank. Yeah. You know, it's changed so much. I mean, I used to like bang my head against the wall trying to get in a room. I couldn't even say the word book. Like, I had to just say, like, and it's based on some underlying material. And let me tell you my log line. Like, I could not say the word book, you know, and realistically, I wouldn't send the book anyway. They're all going to have their little 17-year-old doing coverage if you send in the book. So I don't send the book because they're not going to read it. They're going to have a 17-year-old read it and do coverage. So I rarely send the book in. I do 1-pagers and 5-pagers and 3-pagers. And I do everything I can to not have them read the book. Also, if the executives change, if they have that executive shuffle or and then move on to a new company, they have no record that I've been there. I can bring it right on back in. Cheat. I cheat a lot.
You know what? That's what I really like about you. It's like there was at that conference that we were at, we were now, it's just like coming back to me because this was many years ago. We were each part of a panel that was giving live notes to people who were doing like stage reads or something like that of their stuff. Lane is brutal, like brutal, but I love it because that's, we just did a Reckless Creative podcast about that I co-host with Sadie Dean about feedback that I was editing today. And I love brutal feedback. So like you have to give so much feedback because you're giving feedback to the author. You're giving feedback to the screenwriter. You're giving, I mean, so much of your time is in that, but you also are a writer and director. So can you maybe give, share some thoughts about taking feedback, you know, tips for people to not run and cry in the other room. Or just go run and cry in the other room. I'm all for that. But then plan. But like tips of how like you like the writer and the screenwriter, the author, the screenwriter, you like those feedback conversations.
I mean, look, it's a subjective business. We all know that. 2 people can walk into a movie. 1 person comes out ranting and raving about how much they loved it. 1 person comes out going, that was the biggest piece of crap I ever saw in my whole life. So, you know, you have to take everything with a grain of salt, take nothing personally. Believe me, I sat in rooms and they say, like the exec is saying, what if we did blah, blah, blah? And inside I'm screaming. I'm like, oh, it's a horrible idea. But of course I'm like, that is a great, let me think about that, how we could incorporate that. Like I'm just, you know, yeah, right. So it's, and I think it's about picking and choosing your battles. Just like I do as the director, you can't fight over everything. You have to wait until you have like the important stuff you have to fight over. And the people, it is a relationship business. So the people that I end up working with over and over are people that can take notes, that aren't going to, you know, their feelings aren't going to get hurt. And I don't just go do this. I mean, it's a discussion. It's a collaboration. It's like, here are my thoughts and this is why. And tell me what your thoughts are. Maybe we can find a way to make this work. You know, it's always that type of discussion because it's creative. It's, you know, it's not like do this or die, you know, and we're all lucky to have, well, to be in this business, really, you know, to have the ability to play make-believe all day long. So, you know, it's not, we're not curing cancer. We're making a movie. So God willing, it should be fun.
You know, maybe you're writing a script about cancer and in your research, you discover the cure. So yes. Let's, you know, maybe we will cure cancer here.
Right. Right. No, I think it's really, really like a number one skill to be able to take criticism because you're never going to you're never going to go into a room and everyone's like, we love everything. It's never going to happen, you know? And I, like I said, I fight for things that are worth fighting for and other things. I just go, great. We'll change that. No problem.
Do they remember the note they gave you that you said, no problem. And then you probably come back and they don't even remember the note that they
gave you. You know what? I have learned to write emails that memorializes those kinds of things. Even as a director, when I get notes on a director's cut, I answer back and I go line by line and I answer how we addressed each note and if we could address each note, because I really do want to make sure we have a nice trail because people don't remember. They don't. Yeah. And the most frustrating thing is for you to work your butt off to do a note. And then you go in there and they're like, why'd you do that? And you're like thinking, because you told me to last time. So what I will do is I will send an email. I'll say, hey, really enjoyed our chat today. I know my writer did as well. We're really excited to do blank, 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 and blank that you brought up. They were terrific ideas. And we're going to address those. Not sure how we're going to address this one, but I'll get back to you on that. I keep like a paper trail. Because we all have a million. It's not, you know, being mean. It's like we just have a million projects going on and we forget, you know.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So like, have you had a chance to work with the same author twice or are you still?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Many times. Wow. And screenwriters, I look for screenwriters who have adaptation ability. That is a very particular skill set. Mm-hmm. So I do tend to work with screenwriters over and over again too, because I gotta have that skill set. If they're a great screenwriter, but they've never done adaptation, I've been burned by that.
It's a totally, having had done adaptation, it's a totally different beast.
It is.
And there's like some pluses and minuses to it. Like some of it is like this was the story, you know, but it's not, but you still, like, I would encourage all screenwriters to even just do one of a book that's public domain, just so that you have it in your skill set, because it's choosing which subplots to get rid of, which ones to keep. Maybe you have to have a composite character where you pull a few characters together because you can't have like as many characters that are in. And there's a definite little dance and skill you do with it it's really fun.
That's great advice to give them. And it's something that is a very particular skill, honestly. And you also have to take into account, like, I was on set with Brenda Jackson. I was doing A Brother's Honor, which is her New York Times bestselling first in the trilogy of books. And on top of everything else with the screenwriting part of it, I also had to keep checking in with her on which scenes her people who follow her, her big, you know, entourage that loves her, want to see to make sure I didn't screw up and not put one of their favorite scenes in, even if it's not in the screenplay. Or mess up, you know, a line that they all love. Like I'll never forget, there's this one scene where he's like carrying her to bed. He doesn't go to bed with her. It's very sweet. But he's like singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And I was like, is there any way we can change that? And she said, my audience absolutely loves it. And I was like, okay, then I'm going to talk to the actor and we're going to make it work. And he actually made it very sexy. He kind of hummed it. It was very sexy. Oh, yeah. You know, so it's very important to know what that audience is expecting to see, or they're all going to be real disappointed, you know? And so it is a skill. It is a skill not only to know what to cut and how to change characters and all that other stuff that you rightly so mentioned, but also knowing what the followers of that book are going to be disappointed with if it's not in there. Even if it doesn't fit into your nifty structure, you might have to figure out a way. I mean, that's what we did with Brothers Honor. There were stuff that I was like, oh my God, where do I put this in this three act structure? Because normally I'd cut it out. But she right. said, like, my audience wants to see that scene. It's a highlight for them. I'm like, okay, we'll get it in there. We'll figure it out, you know?
So you get the book before it's published. And now you're talking about what the audience, the readers like about that book before you've, while you're in the screen.
This particular one was already published.
Timeline. Okay. So what is a normal timeline like in terms of book publication, like finding it, the book publication?
Right. You know what? We try, it's a big T try. We try to get them to go concurrently, like mm-hmm. with the Duff. It was really good to have it published right when the movie was coming out. Like we try. It's not yeah. always doable. But look, like with the Duff, like Cody would literally send out like on Facebook to her followers, hey, here's chapters blank through blank. And I know you guys have seen it and are excited. Which thing do you want to see? Like she would, or she'd say, who would you like to see in this role? Like we can get feedback. That's the beauty of social media. We can get so yeah. much feedback that really helps us when we're developing the movie part of it. You know, mm-hmm. it's great.
That is great. Social media is good and bad, but I'm glad that it's good and bad in that regard.
It's bad in casting. I hate when they have like the casting list and you have to list like how many followers they have on Facebook. And I'm like, I don't care. Oh, can they act?
God.
Exactly. It's so annoying.
Sometimes they get so caught up in all this other stuff that,
right?
You know, whatever. So, okay. So the pitching process when you're pitching it, so you're not going in with the finished book. You're going in with just the pitch. Want to kind of talk a little bit about, because I can imagine you're very good in the room. So pitching tips for people.
So one of the things that I spend a lot of time teaching writers who are nervous about pitching mm-hmm. is that they need to look at it like they're sitting around a campfire. And in this campfire, they're telling this really cool story and they want to keep everyone interested.
She's whispering.
Because it makes you lean in and listen. It's such a great tool to use because it's not about being in the room being like, how good am I at pitching? It's like, can you tell the story in a way that's really visual and gets people as if they've seen it and gets them excited about it? That's the goal. So I tend, for example, I tend to, when I do my write-ups, I end at the end of act two, character at their lowest moment. That's where I end my write-ups. Because I want them to call me and go, how does it end? And I'm going to go, funny, you should say that. Why don't we come in and pitch it to you? You know, it's my little sneaky drinks to get in the room. And it's the same thing for when they're pitching. Usually I'll have them stop at the end of act two and be like, okay, so we're at the end of act two. Any questions before I finish? Everyone wants me to finish? Like, we just like leave them with the little breadcrumbs, like hanging there, you know? I think it's really important to do that. I think, you know, because in every movie, you know, if they turn off every movie right at the end of act two, you kill yourself. You want to know, how does this all get fixed, right? That's the big thing. So same thing in the room. And that's how you get people invested. And I always say to them, keep a pitch 15 minutes or less. And of course, the writers have a complete heart attack when I say that. But it's true because I want to leave them wanting more. And if that inspires them to ask a lot of questions, that's great. I'm getting them a little bit pregnant. I'm getting them involved in the conversation, in the project, so that they're part of it and not just being like, okay, thank you. See you later. We'll get back to you. You know, boring.
Where did you learn how to pitch? Like, did you have like some crazy job before this or something? Like...
I've had a lot of crazy jobs. I started as an actress.
What crazy job have you had that you think has helped you the most in this industry?
Well, interestingly enough, so when I went to film school, to the master's program at USC, mm-hmm. everyone else in my class was an undergrad film major. I had done literature and I was an actress and I was like, oh God, I'm doomed. I knew nothing about film, nothing. And the coolest thing is, as I was there, people kept coming up to me going, where are you getting your actors from? And I'm like, I'm getting my actors in the same place you are from, like casting call or whatever. And they would all kind of look at me like, but, and they'd literally ask me to go to their sets of their student projects and talk to their actors. And I was like, oh my God, this thing that I didn't value at all, being able to talk to actors, huge asset. And that is the exact same skill that I use to pitch. It's just like talking to an actor about a character and getting them excited to get on screen and talking about the motivations for that character. And it's the same kind of thing where you have to get in a room and you have to get them excited about the project and invested in the story. And you're doing the same thing when you talk to actors on a set, literally. And so I think it sort of correlated when I got out and started to do producing that I was doing the same thing. I'm literally doing the same thing I would do to an actor, which is let's talk about the characters and let's talk about the cool story and why it works and what's motivating you through it and, you know, your lowest moment and all that stuff.
Is that when you realized you wanted to be a director too, or did you already know that before?
I actually started as a director in high school, believe it or not. I directed my first show at the Old Globe. Mm-hmm. I had always wanted to be a director. Mm-hmm. And I ended up producing because as a director, you're waiting for the phone to ring a lot, and I'm the most impatient person on the planet. So I didn't do really well just sitting by the phone. So I thought, maybe I should start producing my own content. And I remember I got Choke. It was sent to me by Marilyn Atlas, and I read this book, and I thought, oh, there should be a movie, like 1,000 kids a year die from playing the choking game. No one knows about this. What the hell? And I talked to Lifetime about it, and I went to New York, and I met with them, and it was so funny because then I came back and I thought, oh, you know what? I haven't produced in Canada, which is a very different ball game. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to call Orly Adelson and John Eskenas, who is working for her, because they have, and I can be like, hey, partner with me. So I called and they partnered with me, which was great. And then I said to John, so this is going to be really weird, John, but I want to get on our first call and just sort of make it like, oh, and you know, Lane's directing, right? Like, as if it was like a done deal. Because I remember being in a room years and years before where I said, how do you get to direct for Lifetime? And the answer was, you have to have directed for Lifetime. It's that wonderful catch-22. That's our whole industry. And I was like, that is the dumbest answer, but okay. So literally we get on the phone. Very first thing, it was a lovely call. Very first creative call for the choking game. And the executive's like, oh, Lane was so nice. She bugged me in the nicest way over and over again for 6 months, but really excited we're here. And, da, da, da. And then we started talking about, you know, directing. And I had John like chime in. He goes, oh, well, you know, Lane's directing, right? She's attached to direct. And there's this pause. I was like, what if they're going to say anything? And then she was like, oh yeah, right. Okay. And that was it. Oh, so God. I had been directing and then I had this big break and then I managed to get back into directing that way by producing my own content.
Yeah.
Now I'm just directing all the time anyway, but that's how I got back in.
Do you still write? Cause I know, I think the last time I saw you in New York,
yes. a lot of the movies that I've been doing for Lifetime, I wrote, and then also I just did a whole bunch of holiday films, and I don't get credit because I'm not Canadian, but I do a lot of rewriting. We actually have a great writer, Canadian writer, Isabel Dream. She's amazing. But I go in and do a whole polish because it's very self-serving. Like as a director, if the script isn't in shape, it's like you have a bad blueprint for a house. You're not going to build a good house. So I have to make sure the script is really, really structurally sound before I start directing. So I end up writing a lot. And then I literally just got hired to write a script for these guys who are, I can't really talk about it because it's on NDA, but it's an inspirational movie. Hope and a little bit of religious stuff in there and very cool. So I just got hired to write that. And it's funny because he was looking for a writer. I was recommended to him by a friend of mine because he was looking for a writer. And then he's like, oh, wait, you direct too. Well, maybe you could direct this too. I was like, okay.
And I think that's like, if I could go back in time, I probably would be like, you know, now I'm very interested in writing novels, but in the screenwriting world, which I really love too, I would be writer director. I think there's so many options that you have and there's so much you learn about writing from being on set and directing. So maybe could you talk a little bit about how being a director has informed and changed and elevated your writing?
I learned very early on the value of structure. That's mm-hmm. the main thing. Like as when I was writing initially, I was like, oh, I'm just going to write and, you know, move things around and whatever, you know, I was very like flippant about where I put things and when things happened. And as a director, I realized like that three act structure is so important. Like, God, that's important. And even more, and more than even just for me, like I have to be able to say to the actor, hey, you know, you're at the end of act one right now. That's where you're taking on the problem. I need to see that decision. Like, you know, those are important milestones. So that changed my writing. Now, actually, weirdly, when I sit down to write a movie, I actually put in all the important beats first. I literally do like the inciting incident, end of act one, midpoint beat, end of act two, denouement. So I have those beats in and then I fill in all the rest. Because I find that without that, I'm sort of floundering on where I'm going, you know, that really is like a nice roadmap for me. And, yeah. And even as a director, when I'm reading a script, I'm looking, where's the end of act one? Where's the end of act two? Do I need to move things around so it's appropriate? Like I was given a script where act three was like 5 pages. I'm like, no, this must change. So it's changed my writing, a lot. And I also, I guess I used to always say, my husband laughs at me, I used to say writing and directing is a kiss of death, right? Because so many people suck at it. You see a movie, it says written and directed by, you're like, oh, this movie is going to be so bad. Like, it's so true, right? And so what I learned is just like when I produce and direct, a lot of times I produce with my husband. And the day I start directing, I am no longer producing. I literally pass that all to him so I can focus on the directing. So the directing won't suck. It's really important. Same thing with writing, directing. I never fall in love with anything. I have to be able to go, yeah, that line sucks. Throw it away, whatever. I can't be precious about any of the writing or the movie's not going to be good. Like I have to have enough perspective as a director to pretend somebody else wrote it and look at it that way. Otherwise the movie's just going to suck eggs. That's what I've learned.
Yeah. I could see where that could be a little bit challenging for some people. And I've seen it on screen.
Yes. And people fall in love with their own self. Like my editor was laughing on these last three holiday movies we did. I said to him, he's an editor I have not worked with. He's up in Canada, of course. And I said to him, I'm willing to cut anything. And after the three movies, he goes, you know, I didn't believe you. He goes, directors fall in love with their own everything. He goes, you literally were like, you know, and yes, I cry. I sit there and I'm like, I love this part. Then I'm like, okay, cut it. Fuck it. Cut it. You know, it's so hard to do that.
But he can always make you a little reel of just all the stuff he cut.
I know, right? He's like, you are willing to cut. He's like, it was so nice to work with a director who literally said, I'm willing to cut things, and actually was. I mean, yeah. I cut scenes out that like I wanted to cry, but like it made the movie better. So it was worth doing.
And I think
it's like killing your babies, as they say, editing's killing your babies. It is. It's really hard.
It is. But also there are times when you think a scene, what you thought a scene was really great when you were writing it. But then when you actually see it happening in front of you, you're like, oh God, that line is so stupid. Like I only produced a short film years ago because I wanted the experience of what is that like to bring my words to me.
And what great experience.
And also just to understand like everybody's role and what everybody does. And so that I could imagine then when I would go and sit down a feature script, how it would be torn apart and put back together in a cinematic way.
Yes.
And you learn too, that you don't need as much dialogue as you think you need.
You always need less. I'd rather show not tell as a director. I cut mm-hmm. so much dialogue. Though it's interesting. Sometimes it works the other way. I'm like, oh, I hate that line. And an actor will go, well, let me try it. And sometimes they say it and I'm like, oh, they made that work. Wow. But I think it's really important to know that it's a show, not tell. It's a visual medium. You don't have to give them a monologue. Sometimes them saying nothing is phenomenal. Silence can be so powerful, you know, so powerful. And a lot of times too, like when I'm writing, I'm sure you do this. I imagine the people in the roles who I see, you know, even if I could never afford them, because it gives them distinctive voices. Then all the dialogue sounds like they're actually different people speaking as opposed to all the same, because I cast them in my head. So the dialogue is actually coming from that actor, whoever it is that I wanted.
So you've been an actor. So first of all, have you ever wanted to make a cameo appearance in any of your work?
No. I am so glad not to be acting anymore. That was brutal. I that's why I love actors. I mean, they, you know, they are so, I have so much respect for actors. It's boy, they put it out there. It's a very tough job. You're getting, you know, rejected all the time. And when you're finally hired, it's brutal. Like, we shoot these things in like 14 days, 13 days. Like, they're brutal shoots. I told them I'm going to be yelling shit out at you all the time. You know, I don't even cut. Like, I just yell shit out and they go again. It's really fast. So you have to have skills. And I admire, when I'm in front of the screen and I've given them some little tiny tweak of direction, like in this one moment, I need to see you thinking about whatever. I love when I see that. Oh, that is just, for me, that's the highlight. That's why I love directing. That moment is so fabulous.
Yeah. But you must have, even though you don't like acting and you're like, I'm done, I'm not doing this again. Because a lot of people say to writers, go take an acting class, like go do an improv, go do whatever. Like, you know, when you're writing, are you more mindful because you've been an actor about dialogue and things like that, about the direction you give them on the page, or are you thinking?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually give very little. I don't put, like, you know, cheerfully or
right.
Yeah, there's no parentheses because they're going to perform it the way they want to perform it. Mm-hmm. I also never say things like, he gets up from the chair. Like, as a director, maybe he's not in a damn chair, you know. I don't put any of that. And it also makes it a much faster read for someone reading the script because they're not bogged down by big paragraphs of descriptive crap.
Yep.
I always say this when people are writing log lines, and it applies to scripts as well. Take $10 out of your wallet for every word. It's amazing what you can cut out. You will be astonished by how much you can chop out of that script. And it's always for the better because it makes it an easier read. It goes much faster. I don't need to tell the actor to do it cheerfully. I don't need to tell him to get up or down from a chair. That's all going to happen on set, honestly. And so I think it's good advice, actually, to take an acting class for those who don't know how that works. You know?
Yeah, because you do hear that a lot, like to stop using the Rileys and to stop telling an actor what to do. And, you know, and just, yeah, totally. You mentioned log lines multiple times. And so I think we need to take a little bit of a dive into
my book.
For those who don't know, okay, first of all, log lines, I think most writers would probably agree with me, are some of the hardest things to do, to condense you might have to take $100 out per word.
They're really hard.
They're really hard. And sometimes it's easier to write a whole act than to write a log line.
So true.
So Lane has a book out called Sell Your Story in a Single Sentence, and it's been out for a few years. Great book. And so if you could maybe give our audience a few little log line tips that they can start thinking about, that might, things that you think might make, you know, a difference in how they approach it.
So I think the most important thing is to remember that a log line is not a summary of your plot crammed into a sentence. That's what most people think. And they get those little run-ons, you know, little colons, and it just goes on forever, you know. They're a hot mess. And that is just not a log line. So stop trying to cram your entire story plot into one sentence, because that's never going to work. What it really is focusing on what is most unique about your story and highlighting it. That's your log line. Because the goal of a log line is to get the person hearing it to go, wow, that sounds so cool, I want to read it. That's the goal, right? So the example I always give is I met with a woman at a true story, her true story. And boy, this book was just, you know, it was sort of like the movie Traffic. It was all about, you know, her getting involved in drugs and being a drug mule and going to prison, blah, blah, blah. And I kept saying, why is this different? I always ask myself that, you know, because if it's not different, I can't sell it, right? We've already seen Traffic. So we had dinner, we talked, and it finally came out, the thing that I went, oh my God, that's your log line. So the log line is essentially, it's the true story of a woman who at only 19 years old ran the biggest drug cartel in U.S. history. Now you want to read that, don't you?
Yeah.
No, it's cool. Because I've taken the one thing that makes it unique and I've highlighted it. That's what a good log line does for you. I am a huge proponent of log lines, not just because I wrote the book, but because, you know, when I get on the phone with executives, guess what? You have 5 seconds on that phone. So I have to be able to say, hey, let me tell you the log line to get them interested in the project. I don't have more than a couple minutes on the phone. Nobody does. They're busy as crap. And the nice thing is they know if I'm calling, I'm not going to waste their time. In 5 minutes, I'm going to tell them what I have and see if they're interested. So that's the beauty of a log line too. And it's the gift that keeps on giving. Because anyone who says, what are you working on? That's your answer. And your agent needs to sell it to the publisher. They use your log line. And if you have a query letter, guess what goes at the top? Your log line. It literally is the gift that keeps on giving. I am, you know, in love with those little suckers.
Yeah. And they're so challenging and so hard, but once you figure out the little magic of how to do it, and it's like that spark moment too. I feel like sometimes writers, myself included, you get so caught up and bogged down, like trying to figure it out. And then sometimes you need to just walk away.
Yeah.
And it'll happen, you know,
I've done that. Yeah. You need perspective.
Yeah.
Totally.
Or even
and the book has some workbooks in the back too to help, which and I put that in on purpose because I think people need to practice. It's a practice thing, you know.
Yeah.
I can only do it on the fly because I've done it for 10 years now. But it's a trial and error, you know. There's been log lines I've done 100 drafts of. I mean, it just
you know,
it happens.
Yeah. So we've got a bunch of questions in here. So let's pop over there.
Okay.
So Krista had asked, how do you find the authors before they've been published, which you kind of answered, but is that just like through, do you mostly, so I want to elaborate on Krista's question. Krista's lovely, by the way. she would, with, you find the agents, but do you ever take queries from people or do you ever find self-published authors and wonder what their next book is going to be?
I work with probably about 70 writers agents now out of New York. Mm-hmm. So I get most of my authors from the author's agents themselves.
Yeah.
But I also before COVID, you know, I would do a lot of conferences. Mm-hmm. You know, I would do Backspace. I did your, you know, DC thing. I know Thriller Fest has tried to get me there about 15 times, which I've not been able to do. You know, I go to a lot of these, Muse in the Marketplace is one of my favorites. I go to these on purpose because I want to meet writers. I want to hear their cool ideas and what they're working on. And that's a great way to do that, you know? So I try to get my butt to conferences. It's getting a lot harder because I'm directing so much now.
Yeah.
But I used to go a lot more often.
And there's also, like, just to speak of conferences for a second, we have a mutual friend, April Everhart, who is a lit agent. And I remember seeing her. I was so impressed with her. If you go to these conferences where they have agents at, you know.
So helpful.
The ones, because you can watch them and see, is this a person I like? And just that I would want to be friends with or to work with or that I think I have a
match
personality. And I remember April, I was so impressed with her because most of the agents would come in just for the pitching event and listen to pitches and then they were gone. Not her. She stuck around. She went to sessions. People didn't know that she was an agent. She's sitting right next to authors who were raising their hand and asking questions. And she would be like, I like that question that person asked. They're smart. They're thinking about their career. They're not just thinking about their book. And then she'd go up and talk to them.
Yep.
And I mean, it's super, super smart. And I've only seen a handful of agents do that, to really participate in the audience and get with the writers to discover someone.
Absolutely. You know? It's a great, especially like a lot of these places we do one-on-ones. So it's, I mean, it's only 15, 20 minutes, but you really get to talk to somebody about their material and, you know, hear if they're passionate about it and, you know, how they're working on it and how far along they are. And it's a great process. And I've actually had a couple of projects that I've set up from those conferences. I think it's a great thing.
Yeah.
I meet people is obviously through my website, because I do log lines for people.
Right.
And I meet a lot of writers that way as well.
Oh, actually, speaking of, Sharon Powers has a statement in here. She goes, Lane helped come up with a logline for one of my scripts. She has so much insight and her book is great. Learned a lot about writing from it. So much story, character, info, and sell your story in a single sentence.
Oh, so nice. Yeah. Sell it in a sentence. I have a website and you can get help for your, you know, log lines and whatnot. And so I meet a lot of writers that way as well.
And that was not a plant. We did
That's so cool. Wow. I know. That worked out well.
I know. Isn't that wild? But it also shows you that this industry, it really is a small world.
It is. And it's so true.
I think people don't realize that.
You know, reason to make sure that you can take notes and you know, treat people well. I treat everyone the way I would like to be treated. Yes. And I think it's very important because, I mean, honestly, life's too short otherwise.
I know. And this is a collaborative medium. So if you if you're a jerk.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll tell you something I do, but I don't know if you do it. Somebody pitches me an article or, you know, whatever. I look into them a little bit and I will look at their social media. And if they're a hot mess,
right?
Because what are they going to be like if I give them feedback on something? Like, are they going to like start yelling at me?
Yeah.
Sending me angry gifts? Like,
life's too short. It falls into the life's too short category.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I think it's really important to operate in a very transparent fashion. You know, I'm super honest with, like, I'll say to a writer, like, so, you know, stuff's going to change when it gets adapted. You have to be prepared for that. It's not ever going to be your book on screen ever, ever, ever. And, you know, I have to be really, you know, honest about that because it's a different medium. You can't be in a character's head on screen.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with these agents, now that you're not at, somebody's asking about one sheets. When you're dealing with agents, now that you're not physically in New York, and these agents who have upcoming books or, you know, that they want you to know about, okay, they probably send you the log line, but knowing that you're going to fix
it. I wish they did.
But do they usually send you like one sheets?
Yeah, they do. They send me little write-ups, you know, a couple pages, 1 to 2 pages. I wish they would send me log lines. That'd be great. But
maybe you could do a log line class for agents.
I know, right? Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be great because
you should see what I get if I ask for a log line. Oh my God.
Oh, I bet. But a log line class for agents, I think, would be genius.
Right? That'd be so much easier for them to pitch their material. Oh my God.
They would learn a lot. I think we should make that happen. Make that another little niche. Because of all the other things you're doing, you've got time to do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Robin has 70 projects, so she's got a lot of one sheets. So
yeah, I do one pagers a lot just because it makes it easier. Once I pitch the log line, I can say, oh, I have a one pager. I'll send it over to you. Makes it easy. You
know? Yep. So Heidi asks, have you ever taken a query from a screenwriter without going through representation? If so, how did they approach you? Did they name drop some other contact in common? Did you meet them in person? For example, a festival setting, or like them enough to agree to look at their material via email.
So usually it's either at a writer's conference or via an agent, obviously. But 9 times out of 10, it's at a writer's conference. Once in a while, it comes from my Sell It in a Sentence website.
I miss conferences so much.
I know. God, it's been weird not having any conferences. It's been so weird. COVID is such a pain in the butt.
It is. I'm so done. It's just so
Zoom. Our life is Zoom now.
It is. But it's so the energy you get with other writers. It's not, honestly, it's not about the classes and all that kind of stuff.
No, it's true.
It really isn't. It's about being together and, you know, getting that energy and connecting with them and just being around people who, like, I don't know, we're kind of a little bit of freaks. Being around people who kind of get you, you know?
When I went to RWA, I was like, oh my God, there's a whole bunch of people doing romance things that I just love. This is so fun.
Yeah.
It used to be like, those were the books that you like hide the cover so nobody knew what you were reading, you know?
Not anymore. So Ramey's asks, how would a literary agent go about getting a meeting with you, for instance, at a book fair?
So normally, you would just contact my assistant at Vast, which you can find on the website. But since there are no book fairs, you would just contact us and we'd set up a Zoom. So, yeah.
Yeah. What is the one line pitch to a movie producer?
Log line. Like the one I gave. Yes.
Yeah.
Log line.
Trends start with books and then film catches on, or vice versa, or is there even a pattern?
There, as far as I can tell, it goes both ways. Sometimes it's a movie and then we backtrack and make a book. Sometimes it's a book that becomes a movie. I would say probably more often it's a book that becomes a movie, but we do a lot of reverse engineering too. A lot of what I'll do for different execs at different production companies is I'll help them back engineer a book. They'll come up to me and they'll say, we're developing this project as a feature. We need a book. And I'll help them get them in touch with an agent, with a writer. We'll find the right writer. And we're back engineering, basically.
Have you ever put out a movie that before the book came out?
Oh, yeah. That happens too. Because sometimes the book's too early. Like, you know, we had a, I've sold things on an 11-page book proposal. So sometimes it's just too early. Yeah. It happens, you know,
and then
you try to coordinate, but it doesn't always work that way.
And how does the author receive that when maybe the screenwriter made a choice that wasn't in the book yet because the book wasn't done? And then now the author,
you know what? Sometimes they actually borrow it. I've had a book author go, that's a cool idea, and use it in the book. It's so funny. Yeah. So you never know. That happened with my Bloody Mary project. It's hilarious. So you never know.
Yeah. Okay. So Sue asks, what if an author has a synopsis, a Bible, and the character arcs? Is that ever enough for a pitch?
No. So if you have a Bible, it basically means you're doing a series. So you need to have your pilot episode to pitch, and you have to talk about the world and the themes and the tone. There's a whole bunch of things that are part of a series pitch that must be included. You also have to be able to talk about series arcs and also about upcoming episodes. So you need a lot more than that actually for series.
And don't you have, did I see somewhere on your site that you've got a project to develop with NBC, a TV series?
I have one at NBC and I have one at Sony and I have one at Hallmark Channel, all series. Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, it's been crazy.
It's crazy. Busy. This is why what you can't see is you can feel free to drink your wine.
Yeah, here you go. This will tell you.
Right here.
I'm a lot less subtle than Jean is about her wine with her little coffee cup.
Yeah, I love my Reckless Creative mug, so I'm very loyal to that. Do you specialize in certain genres?
That's a great question. Actually, there's only two genres that I don't do at all. I don't do historical, like World War II stuff, World War I stuff, just because it bores me. and I don't do gory horror. I do psychological horror, but I don't do like Saw. And like, ugh.
Yeah.
But other than that, I do everything. Absolutely everything. I ended up in YA a lot just because of the DOF. But you know, like the project I have at Sony, it's a retelling of the Frankenstein. It's a reimagining of the Frankenstein story from a female point of view. So it's completely, way different. And then the one at NBC is about a world where they can separate mind and body. So you can actually go into someone else's body. I mean, into a computer, someone else can take over your body and like work you out or get you off drugs or whatever. And then you get your body back. So that gets very sci-fi. And the one at Hallmark Channel is a romance, is an African-American comedic romance series. So, you know, it runs the gamut. It really does. Yes.
But I'm just still stuck on somebody can come into my body and work out for me.
Yes. Yes.
And then I can
That's
get
the thing that attracted me about the book. I was like, wait a minute. Wait. I want that.
It's
worse. You know, like people who have money, if their kid has lupus, they buy him someone else's body. Oh. You didn't necessarily want that to happen. You know, there's all kinds of crazy crap going on.
Oh, but that's great though. Lots of.
Yeah, because you don't know who's in what body. Is the president or someone else in there? Kind of cool, huh?
It's kind of like the Love Boat with bodies.
I like the little outside the box kind of projects, you know.
But those are perfect examples of what attracts you. Those things that are different,
you know, not the
same thing that you've seen over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Leanne asks, you said you work with both people who have been previously published, as well as people who haven't done anything yet. How do you meet those who are just starting out?
So conferences. I go to a lot of writers' conferences. Sometimes I meet them, you know, via the website, sellinasentence.com, but mostly either at writers' conferences or, you know, if they are represented, obviously the agents always introduce me to new writers that they're repping.
Are you adding more agents to your roster of...
All the time. Yep. All the time.
So that's cool. And you probably find them from references from other agents or...
Yeah. Like one agent I work with a lot back before COVID, she actually scheduled a lunch with all these agents that she knew at various agencies who didn't know me. And we had a big lunch and she introduced me to them all. It was very cool.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
See, I like to do that too. Like just while we're on this subject for 1 second, some networking tips, because that's a great little networking tip. Like when I come out to LA, I try to get friends together who don't know each other, but I think they would like each other, because then they end up having warm and fuzzy feelings about you.
Exactly. It's a great way to expand your network, you know, and it doesn't feel forced, like, oh, we're having a happy hour at a conference and we all have to talk to each other, you know.
Yes.
I'd rather break bread with a whole bunch of people and chat, you know.
Yeah.
More fun.
And networking is challenging for people who don't live in LA or the literary world don't live in New York, but
well,
now media,
now Zoom, I mean, it's a lot different, you know, I mean, I'm a big proponent of get your face there. Like that's how I got the Duff. I was sitting in her office when it came in, like get there. You know, a lot of people get lazy and they're like, have my assistant call and ask for a copy of the galleys. Like that was never me. I'm like, I'm getting my butt on a plane and I'm getting out there, you know? It's like we have a deal right now with Up TV for these. I did 3 holiday movies last year. I'm directing 4 more this year. And I kept waiting for them to set up this meeting at Up TV, which is in Atlanta. I'm waiting. It gets to be like December. And, you know, it's like, it's because the Canadians are so nice. Nobody wants to push, you know. And so finally, I knew the woman because I had, you know, she had given me notes as a director and I write her back. And so I wrote her note. And I'm like, guess what? I'm coming to Atlanta. So I'm making it up. She's like, when are you coming? I'm like, next week. Is there any chance we can connect for lunch while I'm there? Magically, I bought a ticket and went out. I only spent 1 night and I didn't even get an Uber. Like, I was like, I'm just going to go. I'm going to take the shuttle to the hotel. I did Uber to lunch with her and then back. And that was it. No rental car, nothing. It was actually quite inexpensive. And it was great because I sat with her at lunch, her face, my face. I talked about the projects. And we have a big Zoom now on Wednesday. And it's really because I freaking got my butt out there and sat with her. I think that's like a thing of the past. Like people just don't do that. And I'm very big on get your butt on a plane, get there. And
I actually did that in Atlanta too, to a trip to Atlanta. When I wanted to adapt a book, the author was in Atlanta and I said to him, hey, I'm going to be in Atlanta on business next week.
Exactly. You know,
I had no business in Atlanta. I even went to the airport because I didn't even have a ticket.
You're so awesome.
To the airport and I was like, this is why we love each other.
This is why we're friends right here.
Yeah.
We do crazy things.
But it's you gotta have a little chutzpah. You gotta to stand out, you know? I think I admitted to him finally, like later, that I didn't really have any business, but whatever. I have no regrets.
I just told her I was there for location scouting. I thought that counts. It's kind of location scouting. I haven't been to Atlanta.
Well, and then while I was there, I stayed in the, what the heck is the name of that hotel that Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara stayed
in?
Oh
my God, how great.
So I was like, I may never be to Atlanta again.
How fun. Oh, I wish I had done that.
Yeah, I will, you know. I think it was across the street from the Fox Theater or something. So somebody else asks about, would you accept self-published nonfiction books already self-published? Do you ever acquire books that are already out there, or do you like to get them before?
I really like to get them before. It's just easier for me to sell them if I get them before.
Which is interesting to me.
I'm not the biggest fan of self-published, in honesty. I've just found that when people don't have other people reading their stuff, like an agent and an editor and a publisher, sometimes it's just not that good because you have no one else helping you hone it. Mm-hmm. It's rare that I find self-published books that are worth it. Honestly, it's very rare. And it's really, like I said, it's just because, not that you're not a good writer, but like you need that entourage to help you hone it and to know how to market it.
Yeah.
That's and the problem. People nowadays just go, I'm going to publish. Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Because trying to find an agent is a lot of work and, querying agents and all of that, a lot of work. There are some hybrid publishers that I think are a little different model because then the writer does have to work with an editor.
And I love that. Yep.
So anytime, I'm sure that it makes you feel more confident working with somebody who you already know knows how to take feedback.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because if they're difficult, there's 50 other people who won't be difficult to work with. You know, that's the thing.
You're right.
It's the same thing with actors. I don't want to work with actors who have, I always have three rules. Excuse my French. No attitude, no ego, and no assholes. Those are my rules. Because I don't want to work with that. Like, I can find other actors who don't have those things who are just as good. And otherwise, it's no fun.
And if they're a little hungry, that's always good too.
Yeah.
You can't have an attitude and be hungry at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, definitely not. Andrew asks, what's a couple of specific examples of a difficult problem solving in development and production that helped keep projects on track? Development hell.
I just had a big problem actually at Hallmark. So I guess I'm telling stories out of school a little bit, but they have the way that Hallmark works. If you want to do a series, they have to do what's called the backdoor pilot to series. It's a 2-hour movie that becomes the series. That's just how they work. They don't just go to series. They always do the movie first. And if the movie does really well, guess what? Becomes a series. So we had always discussed this project as a backdoor pilot to series. Mm-hmm. And it was done in April of last year. The big like, yay, we're doing this. And then how this industry works, it's big executive shuffle. People left. People went to different companies. All our cheerleaders were gone. Mm-hmm. And then it took business affairs. For those who don't know, Hallmark is very slow. And that's being very nice in terms of how I'm saying that. It took about 8 months to get our damn paperwork. And by the time we got paperwork, it said, you're doing a movie. And I'm like, a movie? There's 11 books in this series. Why would I option 11 books for one movie? So it really was kind of off the rails and kind of frustrating. And the only thing that saved it is, and I talk about this a lot, it is an industry of relationships. Yeah. And I found out that one of the people who came in to take over is someone I've known for a very long time. I knew her. I took her to lunch when she started off as the itty bitty creative exec at Lifetime years ago. And then she went to Netflix. And anyway, she's now at Hallmark Channel. And because I have that relationship, I sent her a note. I said, you and I, can we talk? And we did a Zoom and we went through the whole thing. And I said, look, you know, I need the paperwork to reflect what we discussed. And for those who are producers, you'll understand why, because you bank that. If you need to go to the bank, the paperwork has to say, this is a backdoor pilot and this is a series. It has to have those words in it because if you're banking a movie, it's not as much money. And also because I can't justify optioning 11 books for one movie. So it was a big, and I hate doing those calls. I hate doing the like, okay, I'm going to have to like grovel and, you know, but I just said, look, I'm like, I'm just calling you because I want you to know what's going on. And I just want to discuss it with you in a way. And if you end up saying, see you later, bye, or whatever, no problem. And I even said like, there's never any guarantees it's going to go to series anyway. I just need the paperwork to be reflective of that so that I can bank it, so that I can, because there's always a gap, what they call a gap in the way Hallmark works. Like, I'm making this up. I don't remember the figures, but let's say you get $1.5 million. They want you to do the movie for $2.1 million. So that $600,000 is your gap. You have to come up with that money. So it's very tricky. And I had not run into that before. And it was very challenging. It's, you know, you're in the process of development. We're expanding our 1-hour pilot script to a 2-hour pilot script. And suddenly all the paperwork's wrong. And the new people don't know the project. So they're like, yeah, it's a movie. You're like, oh my God, all the people who knew this project are now gone. So yeah, when things drag out, it can be very frustrating. There's a lot of executive shuffle, what they call, you know, where people move. Executives move all the time. And, yeah, you know, I'm very big on having cheerleaders at the company that I'm working with, even if they're the tiniest itty bitty exec, I don't care. They don't have to be VP of whatever. If they're a cheerleader for your project, it's great. But when they leave, that's where it gets tricky.
Yeah. Until they go to some other place you like.
That's right. Unless you move up somewhere else and then you're like
somewhere else. Okay. So I'm skipping over some things that I feel like we've already addressed. So here's a question that we have not addressed. What is your daily schedule like? How do you juggle being a producer, director, writer, providing feedback, being a CEO, everything else, being a wife, being a wine connoisseur, having somebody work your body out? How do you handle all of that?
Oh God, it's such a, that's such a good question. It's hard. damn, it's hard. But you know this too, look at you, you're renovating a house right now. It's hard. I mean, right now, you know, I have this screenwriting gig that I'm supposed to be working on, and I have a thriller that's supposed to be going in March here that we're trying to location scout for, and I'm doing the budget for that. And I have the call on Wednesday for the 4 romance movies in Canada, which already I'm working with the screenwriter on the very first screenplay. It gets a little nutty, honestly. I had some funny things last year when I was doing all three movies at the same time, where like the producer would be like, hey, can you send me the whatever? And I sent it to him. He goes, this is for the other movie. I'm like, oh, right, this one. Okay. Like I couldn't remember which movie we were doing. It's terrible. And it gets harder as you get older. it's, you know, it's very challenging. And I do a lot of work with New York. So I'm up early, you know, because I'm trying to do New York hours as well. You know, it's here's the good part. I'm doing what I want to be doing all the time. It's fun, you know, so it doesn't matter if I work weekends and, you know, work until midnight like I did last night. And like, I don't care because I'm doing what I enjoy. It's fun. You know, it never feels like work when you're doing what you enjoy. So it's crazy. And it takes a lot of careful scheduling, especially when I get to set, when I'm directing it, it's really, really hard to do other things because I wanna focus just on that. But it's you know, they say it's good problems to have, you know, it's really good problems to have.
Yeah. And it's when you don't like your job that it feels like it's.
Yeah. Had a lot of those on the way up.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, me too. Just quite a few. And Stephen asked, what are your thoughts about limited TV series adaptations versus film?
Steve Stiefel. I know Steve Stiefel. I'm doing limited series. That's what I'm doing at Sony right now. I mean, they're totally different. You know, something speaks to you as a feature film because it has a bigger world. That's how I look at it. The Frankenstein story is told from the ward of the Frankensteins, and she lives with them and all that. It's a smaller world, so it really felt like it was limited series. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel like a feature to me. But sometimes they switch, you know. Initially, the screenwriter thought she would pitch it as a feature, and then she revamped and pitched it as limited series. So, you know, and sometimes that's what happens. I have another project that we pitched with different writers all over town as a feature, didn't sell. Now we have a different writer working on it as a series for Hulu. So, you know, they're very different birds. I think it always has to do with the world. Is the world big enough to justify going on a big screen? That's how I look at it.
And do you feel like, because a lot of times when you see, not necessarily a lot of times, but a handful of times you see a limited series come out and it's successful, like Ozark, and then they pick it up.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then it goes on and on, which is really cool.
Yep. There's a couple questions of people asking about pitching you and if you accept manuscripts and whatnot. I'll just leave that to you.
Yeah. I mean, it needs to come usually through the agents that I work with most of the time. Otherwise, I mean, honestly, I get 900 and something submissions a year. I'd be so overloaded. I'm already overloaded.
Oh, but, yeah.
I like to read stuff myself. I don't like to pass it along to anybody. So that's the only way I can keep the numbers somewhat reasonable, is that I go through the agents that I work with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's understandable. But I do, even though you've said that, I do appreciate people asking because you need chutzpah.
It's true. It's true. And believe me, I have both from you, I think, and even from my friend Jen Wilkov, like I've had people call me and say, hey, I worked with this writer. They have a really cool idea. Can I send you a one pager? Yeah. If I know you and I trust your judgment, yeah. You know?
Yeah. I'm going to just say a little side note to Ruth out there, my co-director of Symposium. If you could grab the link to Lane's book, Sell Your Story in a Single Sentence. Somebody was asking if we could pop it in the chat, but don't worry because we will grab the link to the book and we'll send it to you when we send you the recording of this. So don't worry. We'll get that link out there. Does the manuscript have to be represented by an agent? You express interest, which we've already addressed, the link to the book. And she does take queries through agents. And finishing up. Oh, how often are memoirs adapted for the screen? Do you ever pick those up?
You know, what's cool is that I do pick up memoirs. It used to be that in Hollywood, you had to have the memoir had to be like someone famous. It had to be like, you know, Abraham Lincoln or whatever. And that's all changed. Now it can be, you know, the guy who saved the girl on the airplane by hugging her too tight, you know, like, it's all changed. So yeah, memoirs are very, very popular. Absolutely.
But like that based on a true story.
Yeah. And if you love a story and you don't have the rights to that story or you can't get the rights to that story, you can always do an adaptation that's inspired by instead of based on. So in other words, it's very loosely based on that material rather than directly based on that material.
Elaine has all those little workaround tricks. Which we've already well established. So Martin asked, besides yourself, do you know any other agents who specialize in books being adapted for film? They all kind of have handle film rights.
I'm not really an agent, just to specify. Right. I'm a producer, director, writer. But almost all the book agents that I know do deal with book to film. They have to. Mm-hmm. And if they don't necessarily represent that section, what'll happen is like, I'll say to them, do you need me to get you in touch with an actual film agent here in LA for when we do the deal? Usually they know people, but I do too. So they'll partner up with a film agent when that time comes. But all the agents that deal with books, they all have to handle it because it's become such a big arena now.
Yeah. So back to a social media question, Leanne wanted to know how important you thought it was for novelists and screenwriters to have a social media presence.
If you can say I have 1 million followers on Facebook, that's ammunition for me for when I sell your material to the studios and networks. Mm-hmm. That just helps me. So I think it's a big plus, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Is it a big minus if they don't?
It's harder to sell them if they don't. You know, ammunition is a big thing. I'm always looking for ammunition. It's like the books that we're doing are with Beverly Jenkins. And Beverly's, you know, a phenomenal romance, African-American romance writer. But when we started with her years ago, she has a huge following, but nobody knew who she was. Well, the agent called me and said, hey, does it matter? She just got named one of the top 20 African-American writers to watch over the last 100 years. And I'm like, yes, ammunition. Yes. I love that because it allows me to bug people about her project in the best way. I'm not just going, hey, what's happening? I'm actually writing them saying, guess what? I just heard blah, blah, blah. So I'm bugging them, but with great information. Ammunition is a beautiful thing.
It is, definitely. Somebody asked, I'm an unrepped script novelist, short story writer with tons of material. How does that help or hinder? Because I'm not quite sure I understand it. Does it, because do you, Robin, do you think you have too much stuff? And you're still,
I mean, you can never have too much stuff.
Yeah.
But get repped. If you have a lot of material, start looking for some representation. It's a great way to get representation is when you've got a lot of stuff to show.
Because we've already established content is king.
Content is king. It's so true.
It is.
It's so true.
And there's, and you know, but there, and also the querying process is very stressful and overwhelming for writers. So, but we actually have a, I'll tell you guys about it later. We actually have a symposium coming up that's going to all about querying.
Ah, nice.
Nice little plug there. And Amelia said, in promoting 1 to 20 pages of someone's book, do those pages come from novels or short stories? Or are they just like a section, chapter, first chapter, or is it sort of like more of a proposal?
Usually it's a book proposal. Mm-hmm. Usually it's an actual book proposal. And that book proposal usually has a couple chapters in it. It has some comps usually. Mm-hmm. It has, so you have your sample chapters, you have comps, you have the backstory. Why are you the one to be writing this? There's a whole
format
for book proposals.
Yeah. Is it sort of, mostly we hear about book proposals in the nonfiction world. So is it that you take this nonfiction book proposal, but do it for a fiction?
Yes, absolutely. I get them for a lot of fiction books, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to help sell the material. And like I said, a lot of times I set up, what was the name of that darn book? It was so cool. Confessions of a Sociopath.
Oh,
and that book I sold to Hollywood on an 11-page book proposal. There was no book yet because I wanted to test her first to make sure it was legit and all that. And so I just sold it on the book proposal because it's a very high concept, obviously, story.
Yes. And I think we all know a sociopath somewhere in our lives.
Yeah. Especially in this industry, there's lots of them.
Oh, totally. Is it a good idea to keep entering your book in contests if your book never makes it through to the final stage? Probably meaning to make it through to the finalist.
I mean, I'm not a big fan of book contests, honestly, because who knows who the heck is reading that. I personally think it's better for you to work on your book and obviously in your writing group, have people who know writing, give you notes and keep working on it and finessing it and honing it. And get it out to agents, you know, get it somewhere where it's going to help you. I don't think winning a book contest is necessarily going to be the biggest help in the world. Could be wrong, but.
And I think it depends on the contest and depends on the, I would say for anybody who asks about contests, my answer is always find the finalists of whatever that contest is and then ask them, how was their.
Yeah. Contest? Great idea. Yeah.
Did that help you? Did that help you?
Did they get any
meetings? Because then you're really getting the person's experience and that makes a big difference because then there's no smoke and mirrors. You get right down to it.
Right.
Ginger asks, what advice would you have for someone just starting out and still working on their first book manuscript? What should newcomers be mentally prepared for?
Oh, you know this answer. Lots of work, lots of rewriting, lots and lots and lots of rewriting and learning to take notes and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. I always recommend doing a log line first. Otherwise, you're going to have to rewrite it later. Mm-hmm. The log line, as you'll find from my book, is very helpful. It's like a rudder on a boat. It really keeps you in the right direction in your writing. And you'll know what you don't need and what you do need based on that log line. So it's very helpful. To write a log line first, but rewriting.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I want to ask you one question. When you talked about log lines, I forgot to ask you earlier when you were talking about structure. Is there some structure that you like? Like, is it that you recommend to writers? Is it Blake Snyder's beat sheet? Is it
one sentence? Nope, one sentence. That's it. And the way that I teach it is you
mean decide the whole story structure, not the
who is the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
What do they want? And this is a very specific want. This isn't a want like I want to, you know, make everyone fall in love in the world or have peace. This is a very specific want. So who's the protagonist? What do they want? Like, I want to steal the Queen's diamond from India. Very specific, right? And then what happens if they do not achieve that want? Those are the three questions. Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised how many times people are laughing at the who's your protagonist, but sometimes the antagonist is who they've been pitching. Like this story, this guy was like finding haunted houses them and using them as time portals to change the past. And I'm like, yeah, that's your antagonist. Who's the pro? And it turns out the protagonist was his assistant, his secretary, who discovered what he was doing and had to fix it before he erased her by going back. So who's your protagonist? What do they want very specifically? And what happens if they do not achieve it, which is the what is at stake? Those are in every log line. And sometimes the stakes are implied, like the one I pitched about the woman who ran the drug cartel. Obviously, the stakes are she'll die because she's in a drug cartel.
I was talking about like story structure. Like, so when you were talking about the beats of the story, do you recommend any sort of resource for writers about structure? Because structure is so important.
Oh, for the screenplay.
Yeah. Yeah. Or in the novel.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many books on screenplay structure. Oh my God. Yeah. I don't know if I could hone it down to one.
Oh, that's fine. I didn't know if there was something that you, because some people are like, oh yeah, definitely this, you know? So I always like to ask.
There's a lot of books on screenplay structure and it's vital. Like if you don't know structure, don't start writing until you know structure, because it really will help you not be rambly and not have your character. A lot of times they have with first time screenwriters, I find, I always say they have this thing where it's called an event to event to event. In other words, this happens, then that happens, then that happens. But there's no motivation. There's no reason why. Things are just happening to them. Mm-hmm. And that's because they don't have structure. Mm-hmm. It's just a bunch of events stuck together. Mm-hmm. And that's never going to work properly, especially in a film format when you try to adapt it.
Mm-hmm. My apologies to Robin. Robin, I used the wrong pronoun. Robin's a he. My apologies, Robin. And Robin is also Sherman Oaks College alumni. Amina, she is an amazing writer. Let me just tell you that. She send you a link to some of her stuff that she's put up on Pipeline Artist. She's a really good writer. Book to film is common, but what about book to limited series or TV series? And what about a screenwriter slash author writing the book and the pilot?
So actually now book to limited series and book to TV series are just as common. Used to be more film, but now it's everywhere. And I think I mentioned, I do not recommend that the author write their pilot, or their screenplay. Because the way things get made is you get some big muckety muck who gets a lot of money to do that, to do it for you. And then as you start building a resume, you can ask for that. But when you're starting out, the smart thing to do is to get a big showrunner muckety muck to be writing for you so that your show actually gets made.
And it's interesting too, because I used to love to go down to the New York Writes Fair, and that's as part of Book Expo. And I used to love to go there and listen to this.
Yeah, everyone was at little tables. It was so easy. Yeah. You just hopped around meeting people.
Yes. And there was one producer, I can't remember whether she was from HBO. I can't remember where she was from, but she was actually saying at that time, this was probably 3 years ago, the last time I went, because it was pre the Rona. And she was saying that for them, I don't know that it was HBO, I can't remember, but it was one of the large companies. And she was saying they actually are more open to an author writing their first draft of a script, because then it gets them further. You're going to get fired, but they're... But it gives them something to start with, like in the development process.
Yes, they are going to get fired.
Something, but you're going to get fired, but you're welcome to try. Basically what she said, which I thought was nice. Funny. But, you know, learning new skill sets, I'm all about that. And Amelia wanted to know if you've ever turned short stories into a series.
You can, absolutely. I personally have not, but I know it's done all the time. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mary, I'm writing an animated feature, and while reading several nonfiction books for research, I found I was relying more and more on one book in particular. So I contacted the author, who gave me a licensing agreement, but now I feel my script isn't really a true adaptation. Have you run into that at all? Like, so when the author's adapting it, it really kind of, I mean, the screenwriter's
veered off. So then it's just inspired by, you actually don't even need the agreement now if it's really not 100% based on it.
There you go. Saves you some money.
Inspired by. Saves you some money later. Yeah, exactly.
Does it also save you some legal problems? Like when you, like, so say you see an article in the newspaper and you want to write something based off of that. I mean, like, you know, getting life rights or getting whatever, if it's inspired by, is that enough to keep you out of legal hot water?
Yeah. So, yes. One of the first movies I did for a lifetime was based on an article, actually. And it was, I'm trying to think of what it came out as. Blanking on the name of the movie. But it was about this woman who was in this PTA, and then they all like blacklisted her, blackballed her, whatever. And like they planted drugs in her car and all kinds of crazy stuff. And it was all real. And so Lifetime brought me on to direct this movie and said it's inspired by true events. They did not go get the life rights. They did not base it on that. At the beginning, it says inspired by. It does not say based on. And that's how you get legally around that.
And do they change the names? Do you have to change the names?
Everything? Yeah. I mean, they saw the guy planting drugs in her car, but it was very different. And they just changed, you know, they changed enough that even though you knew it was somewhat based on that article, it wasn't her story. And that's what you have to do.
What about stage plays? Do you ever look at those?
I have not, just because I think that's a tough, that adaptation to a movie is going to be really tough, I think. I know in the past, people have done it successfully. It's such a different, gosh, stage plays are so different.
Not more dialogue heavy.
Yeah. And they're just not, I think they're a much harder adaptation. Let's put it that way. I think that's a lot more difficult for someone to adapt. I don't think it's impossible, but I have not taken on that challenge. Let's put it that way.
Ah, here's a good question, because I was actually wondering this myself. Heidi asks, when you say you don't do historic, does that mean you wouldn't do something like Bridgerton or The Notebook that has a romance set in a different period?
Oh, I would totally do those. I'm a big fat romance whore. I wouldn't do, you know, like guys with, you know, cannons and tanks blowing each other up over the German border. That's what I mean by historical. So like, I don't care about people killing each other.
You wouldn't do something war related because that's also the gory part, whatever.
Exactly. I don't need people with their limbs blown off and, you know, all that horrible
stuff.
But
if it's a period piece.
No problem. Yeah. It's a lot harder to get period done though, as you know, really hard.
And you know, what's interesting is because you always hear that and then a period show comes on and my husband turns to me and says, gee, nobody makes period anymore.
I know.
And they're so good.
Like, it's so typical of this industry. You know, the minute everybody says they can't do it, one will come out, do really well, and then everybody wants one. That is so typical.
It's so crazy. Do you have to have an agent for your book to be considered for film?
You do not, but it helps. It helps big time because you're going to need someone to negotiate for you. For all your contracts and whatnot. And an agent will do that for you.
But I would imagine that if you had a deal coming, if you were bringing a deal to a table, an agent would raise their hand because they can
make 100%,
you know.
Of course, make their life easy.
Yeah, you did all the legwork. And I'm a big fan of going after stuff. I got so many things and I wasn't repped. You know, I mean, then I was repped and that was certainly easier because you can, getting meetings and all the other stuff. I had a ton of meetings. It's life is definitely easier when you're repped, but you don't discount chutzpah and
that's right.
Being creative. And, you know,
I didn't know anyone when I started in this industry. I didn't have relationships with anybody.
No,
you just went out and did it. Screw it.
Yeah. Do you do any deals and with like HBO or are you more?
Yeah. Bob Conti was my connection at HBO who just left. He had one of those moments of like, oh, I'm so tired of the coronavirus and I don't want to be sitting at HBO anymore. But I still know people there and I love HBO. It's just there. Oh, can I say this? Sure. Why not? I had wine. They're kind of star fuckers. They like really big names or they don't want to talk to you. So I don't tend to work with them that often, but there you go. Yeah, I mean, that's what happens.
I know. And I think that people I find honesty so refreshing. And when people, here's the thing that I always say, like a pipeline artist, when I'm working with our contributors and we're pitching ideas for articles back and forth, I always say to them, you know, just tell people what they need to hear, you know, not what you think they want to hear. Like
that's if right.
nobody, when you're blowing smoke up people's asses, that just helps no one. Like that's right. It helps no one. It takes you longer to achieve your dreams if you're believing this crap that people are saying to you.
That's right.
It's better to know up front so then you can figure out a realistic plan. This is kind of how I like my feedback too. Just really slap me inside the head, like really direct. So advice about finding a literary agent or I have an entertainment lawyer for screenwriting projects, but no agent for my books. So they've got an entertainment lawyer for their screenwriting, but they don't have anything yet for their books.
So there's a million lit agents in New York. There's millions of them. Do your research. Like, I hate when people contact me and they're like, I have a screenplay. It's like, I do books, guys. You know, if you don't have a book, why are you bugging me? Do your research. And you'll find a lot of agents out of New York. Find the agents who are doing the genres that you're writing. And a lot of them open for queries. A lot of them. Mm-hmm. So wait till they open for queries and send them a query letter. It's really not that tough to do. And if you're smart, you have a log line at the top. And I guarantee you, people are always, content is king, as we like to say. People are always looking for material. I mean, that's the beauty. People are always looking for material, both in my industry, in the book industry, they need more stuff. So believe me, you should be querying because you'll find an agent because there's probably someone out there looking for your kind of material.
Yeah. And also too, when you like go look on their site, they'll have submission guidelines, all that stuff.
Yep.
Also go look at their Twitter because often on their Twitter, pinned tweet to the top will say, I'm closed for submissions. And then when they're reopened, they'll change the tweet and say, I'm open. And
exactly. So
like certain hashtags you can follow on Twitter too, that like manuscript wish list and things that.
Yeah. It's really great. Especially if you find someone who you know is doing the material that you write, bug them in the nicest way. I'll tell you how I bug people. I send them emails and in the subject line, it just says poke, poke. That's it. I send it out. It's like, they know what I'm bugging them about. I don't have to keep bugging them. I send them little thing that's poke, poke. And they're like, oh crap. I didn't get back to Lang.
Do you even put anything in the body of the email? Just
poke, poke. That's it.
Well, I know when I get one of those emails from you, I'll start digging through. What did I
do? I bug them in the nicest way.
I like that. I like that strategy. That's really good. Something was going to ask you. I can't remember what it was, but it doesn't matter.
Laura. Hi, Laura.
She just wants to say hi. Laura actually has
articles. She has a great book called Out that we tried to get made. Great
yep. book. And she's got, she writes for us at Pipeline Artists too.
She's awesome.
Yeah. Hi. Sal said Pity Pat's porch.
I don't know.
I don't know what that means. I'm sorry, Sal. Lisa, do you know the reason behind studios' preferences for pre-existing IP? And how do you feel about selling original screenplays? Is that less marketable?
It is less marketable right now. And yes, the preference for IP is because it already has an audience, essentially. If it's got a book, they assume that audience who bought that book is already an audience for the film. So it's a pre-existing audience. So that's why they like it so much.
Yeah.
And also the people who follow that author, who are big fans of that author, they're going to go see the movie or TV show. So yeah, built-in audience. That is the reason for the big hoo-ha of IP.
And I think it got really big too when the writer's strike happened because it was art. They had stories that were already out there.
That's right.
Screenwriters were on strike. So
that's right.
That's kind of like the shift. What about like book option fees? Like what would a
normal do you ever sleep? Option?
Yeah, I did see that one.
Not much, actually.
Yeah, I don't either. I've got insomnia. So
book option fees. So back when I started, you used to option everything. Like that was the way to go. You just optioned, right? I don't do that anymore. I learned the hard way on the duff that the way the process works is if I option it, let's say I option that for $2,500. When I set that up with the studio assumes that option and they pay back this $2,500. So that's all that writer gets is that $2,500. Mm-hmm. Now that sucks. Now, granted, they're still going to get the purchase price and whatever else they've negotiated. But the option fee is like itty bitty. Because any independent producer can't afford to keep putting out money for option fees. So after the Duff, I learned my lesson and I changed how I did things. And I actually sort of started educating agents, book agents, on do not option the material to the independent producer.
Right.
What you should do is do a shopping agreement, which is what I do for everything. So then when I, you know, take Reboot and I set it up with Peter Ternan at Fox, Fox options the material. They have much deeper pockets than I do. So they'll option for $25,000 instead of $2,500. Mm-hmm. It's a much better deal and it really takes care of the author in a much better way. So I spent a lot of my time educating agents, book agents, about this, that do not do the thing of the past, which is, oh, just option to whoever for $1,000, because that will get assumed by whatever studio or network is taking over. Yes, you'll get your purchase price, but your option fee is that little tiny fee. And that's really unfair to the author. So yeah. I really do not recommend optioning. I'm a very, very anti-option person because I don't think it's fair to the author at all.
This is a screenwriting question. So, but since you are a screenwriter as well, how do you like to see character descriptions in a screenplay? Age, standout characteristics, other. There's one of my friends. Did I ever introduce you to Doug Richardson?
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, I'll talk to you about you later, but I'll make sure you guys meet. He had told me the character description was often what the actor's agent would turn to first to go right there to see, do I want to hand this on to my actor client? Do you, and it's like the one area where he felt was there's a little more wiggle room in being creative. Is that
I'll tell you what I recommend, which is exactly what I recommend to do when you're pitching.
Mm-hmm.
I had a guy I worked with, super awesome screenwriter, who I just loved his pitches. And one of the things he did really well was this character stuff. And this is what I loved about it. So his character, like he would introduce a character. And by the way, I always tell them, do not do like a whole separate paragraph about each character first, like include it in the pitch. So you're immersed in the pitch when you meet the character. I always think that's great. And this is how I like to do characters. So he would say, like, we're meeting so-and-so. And he'd go, you know how sometimes when people stand on a roof, they have to fight the urge to jump? Well, our character has to fight the urge to push other people off. I love that. That's so great, right? And so I always give that example to screenwriters. I say, like, if you're going to write a description, don't just put like 40s, a tired nurse, like, ugh, boring, right? Do something cool and creative. So when people read it, they're like, I want to play that. It falls into exactly what you're talking about, which is really cool, like very short, but a cool description of that character.
Yeah.
It works great for pitches too.
Oh, definitely. I can see that because you automatically can visualize it in your head. I know we're going a little bit over, but I'm trying to get through some of these. Have you ever done based on a personal essay? Like something that somebody said, like, for example, the New York Times Modern Love column?
I have not. I know other producers who have. I personally have not.
Yeah, because you got to be reading everything.
Yeah.
Are there any specific words you should avoid in a log line?
Unless it's inherent in the story, like with the Duff, I don't use the word teen or kid or teenager, mm-hmm. Or child, because let's say they don't want to do a project about a kid, but you have the coolest idea ever. You don't have the time to be able to go, oh, but you can age them up. Just don't say kid. Just say, a guy walks down the street and blah, 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 blah. Let them wonder what his age is. You know, I try to always get rid of the way that they could say no. And that's a typical way to say no. I also say get rid of adjectives. I don't care if they're pretty or beautiful. Again, $10 a word, right? Why do you want to waste it on saying she's beautiful? Who cares? I want to know what she's doing. What is her want and what happens if she doesn't achieve it? I don't care if she's pretty. Right. So I always say to avoid adjectives. You'll learn a lot about this stuff in the book, but yeah. Those are the main ones. And by the way, when I say, like, also don't do names like Stephanie, again, like for $10, you're going to put in Stephanie. I don't know who Stephanie is. Who cares? I want to hear that, you know, she's a female wizard or something. I don't care that her name is Stephanie. Now, granted, if it's, you know, Superman or Hitler, okay, keep it in. But Stephanie's a big no.
Apologies to anyone named Stephanie.
But $10 a word. You gotta be picky. You gotta be really picky at $10 a word. Is Stephanie helping you sell it? No. That's how you know to cut it.
Somebody asked about, are there any kind of organizations that write treatments for novels? They want to send this into their agent with their manuscript and the one-page synopsis.
Normally you write your own treatment.
Yeah.
Normally you write your own. Why would you want somebody else to write it? I'm confused by that, actually.
Maybe they mean the adaptation treatment for the novel, maybe? I don't know. Not quite sure. I apologize. Sure. We'll mull that over.
And by the way, books turned into movies are not always best-selling books. They become best-selling books. Like, nobody heard of The Duff. Nobody. Then it became a bestseller after the movie came out. Mm-hmm. No, it does not have to be a best-selling novel. It helps. But if it's not, it's okay.
Yeah. And
it'll become a bestseller once it comes out anyway.
Right. So agents must really love it when you say, I would like that client's book that isn't even written yet.
Exactly. Which is all I do, pretty much.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine how exciting that must be for the author.
So fun. It is so fun. You're finding things like that nobody else has seen. Like, literally, I've had guys from CAA and ICM. They're like, oh, we've seen them all. And I pitch them like 3 or 4 things. They're like, where are you getting these? I'm like, dudes, I'm seeing things that aren't published yet. I'm seeing things you're not even seeing.
That's so awesome. So if period pieces are hard, someone wanted to know if that the same held true with like medical dramas or fantasies.
Fantasy, unless you're Game of Thrones, good luck. That's a real tough one to get going. And the things that I don't do, now that I'm being specific about television, I don't do medical dramas. I don't do legal. I don't do the ones that you're going to be competing with every A-list showrunner on the earth. There's no point. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be competing with Shonda Rhimes, you know? So I don't ever, you'll hear like the projects I take on are very different. I don't take on your typical standard stuff because then you're competing with the biggest showrunners in the, in all the networks. And guess what? If they have a choice of you or them, guess who's going to win?
Yeah. Somebody wanted to know if there were examples of good adaptation screenplays to read, you know, some script that.
Oh, there's so many. Fault in Our Stars is a great one. Even the Hunger Games ones are quite good. Harry Potter's an unusual one. They did do a lot of changes to that. Trying to think. I personally did not like the Twilight ones, but I suppose you could read those. I mean, there's so many based on books these days. It's silly. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
Many, many, many. Fault in Our Stars is a great adaptation.
And there's like, when I first started writing, you had to buy scripts on eBay.
Right.
I think I'm
Gone Girl too. Oh my God. Gone Girl. Oh, there's a good adaptation.
Oh yeah. That was really good. And then Heidi asks, I want to ask this question because I think it's a good one. Heidi asks, pardon the nitty gritty question. I'm about to sign a shopping agreement with a producer for my script and I have no agent. I met an entertainment attorney through a panel like this and she is great, but wants to charge me $1,500 retainer for a 2-page document. Should I bite the bullet and pay her just to have someone in my corner?
No. And you can get entertainment attorneys who will take a piece of what you make for doing your legal work. I would not pay them $1,500. I would have, usually they take 5%. And I think it's much more worth it if you're a struggling writer, to not be putting out that upfront money. But also, to be honest, if you are making a deal with a well-known producer, you should be approaching some film and television agents, because when you already have a deal in play, amazingly enough, they can't wait to represent you because they're going to get a big fat percentage. So that's a way to go as well. But you really should not need to spend $1,500 just to do that. And I will throw this out there, and please don't have 500,000 people writing me. But if you write to my assistant, Heidi, at info@, I certainly can look over your option agreement for you and let you know if there's any flags without charging you anything, because that's crazy.
Look at you, Heidi. You did. Glad I asked the question for you. Would you plan virtual events to meet agents? I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff out now, like a lot of conferences.
Lot of the conferences have become virtual. Yeah, they've all sort of become virtual now. So they're all like that now. Yeah, everything's on Zoom. It's so sad. I miss meeting people. But there you go.
I know. But it's still great that we've all figured out a way to do this, like us here right now, you know?
Where there's a will, there's a way. Thank God for
saying that. I know. For IP meaning, equaling pre-existing audience, is it hopeless to write a sequel to something you don't own the IP for, or is it possible, especially if the first writer is dead?
Don't write the sequel to something you don't own the IP for. So there's number one. Don't do it. It's a waste of your time. But also, just because a person's dead doesn't mean they don't have an estate that is repped by an agent. So you could still get in trouble. It doesn't, just because it's dead doesn't mean it's home free. If it's public domain, that's different. But it, just because they're dead, that usually they have an agent that represents their estate. So it's not worth it to write a sequel to something where you don't own the IP. In fact, to be honest, it's sometimes hard to get screenwriters to write a screenplay based on IP, because if something happens and that project doesn't go forward, they can't do anything with that screenplay unless they own the IP. So it's very difficult. You have to, I get it done because I have relationships with them and they know I'm not going to let the IP go and I will always have that attachment. But all they can use that script for is basically a writing sample otherwise. So it's not a big plus for writers.
Last, it was something that was in the public domain.
And then different.
In the public domain and you want to write the sequel to Jane Eyre.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Could actually be kind of cool.
Right?
No, could be. Figured out the Pity Pat's Port.
Oh, is that the hotel?
I thought it was the name of the hotel. It wasn't, that wasn't it, but I now want to stay in some place called Pity Pat's Port. So I think we buzzed through, I think I got most of the questions. I just want to ask you one more question. And I just realized I have not had my computer plugged in this entire time, but my battery is doing great. One more question I want to ask you, which is typically the last question I always ask when I talk with somebody.
Uh-oh.
If you could go back, I know, get ready.
Get ready. Where's my wine?
If you could go back in time and say no to me, no, I'm just kidding. If you could go back in time to your 18-year-old self, what advice would you give her? And it doesn't have to be about writing or the industry. Like, you learn a lot of life lessons along the way.
Yeah. I think my number one thing would be to tell myself to enjoy the process. I'm just like all of us, I'm very endpoint oriented. I just want to be there. I just want to get there and be doing it,
Yeah.
But there's something to be said for enjoying meeting people and enjoying the development process and enjoying coming up with new creative ways of getting things done. And, I think we're also like, I want to be there already, that we forget that it is a process. And there's some great things about enjoying the process. Like a lot of the time during COVID, I just wrote I had an idea for a screenplay, a really cool, based on a sort of a reimagining of a public domain thing. And I just thought, I'm just going to give myself permission to just write whatever and just enjoy that process instead of sitting at home and being bummed that, we're all in COVID land and we can't go anywhere and it sucks. And, and I think that when I was younger, I was so like, I just have to get this made and I have to get here and I have to make sure I sell this. And it was all about the end result rather than enjoying developing it with the screenwriter or figuring out a fun way to do the pitch and do neat visuals. Or, I wasn't about the process. I was about getting it sold, get it made. And I think now that I'm older, I've learned not everything's going to get made. I've set up a million things that haven't gotten made. And it's not about that. It's about having the relationships with the executives. As my husband likes to say, have a cup of coffee, Earl, from Aaron Brockovich. Go take them for coffee. don't talk about projects, don't talk about anything you're doing, just sit and have a coffee for FSEC, you know? I think that's really important. I think people forget that because it is about relationships, you just need to like slow down a little bit and just enjoy people's time, you know? And whether it's a screenwriter that you're getting to know who's working with you on, like, I don't just call them just to give them notes. Like, I'll call when it wasn't COVID and be like, hey, should we go grab a Starbucks and just hang out and let me get to know you? And what else are you working on besides my crap? And, you know, it's and you never know. I mean, I had an agent call me and ask me if I could sit with a client that he had who was an author working with a company in Canada. And I'm like, sure. So we sat, we had eggs, we had coffee, we hung out, and he was telling me about all the stuff he was working on. And when he finished, he said, I can't tell you how much I appreciate, you know, your time. And one of the things in the, you know, hour and a half conversation I mentioned to him is that I was looking for a foreign distribution company, because I knew nothing about that at the time. And he called me like a week later. He goes, you know, this company I'm working with in Canada does foreign distribution. Maybe I'll just, can I introduce you? Like, you were so nice to spend an hour with me. And I'm like, sure. And it turns out that's the company. 3.5 years later, I'm now working with doing these romantic comedies, movies for I'm directing for every year now, these holiday movies. So you just never know. You just go, you know, into things with an open heart, not like I want to get this and I want to get that. It's like, look, like I'm in charge for this time or whatever with you. Like, you're my friend and this is fun. And like, just, you know, give of yourself and treat people the way you want to be treated and slow down and try to enjoy the process. It's not always about getting this made, getting that made. It's about trying to enjoy that process and meet other really cool creative people, because I love creative people. They're the best, you know, they really are.
Well, you are the best, Lane. And I'm so grateful that you did this. And when we first came up with the idea of a one-on-one, I was like, I know our girl. No, because you cover all of the areas that we, you know, we do a pipeline, and I knew that you would be just fun and full of energy and great information. And I cannot thank you enough. You didn't even finish your glass of wine.
I know. I got it. I'm clearly slacking. I must get to that.
Hello.
Well, no, this was super fun. I hope people found it helpful.
I think they did. Everyone's in the chat giving applause and thanking you. So thank you. And also thank everybody else for being here, because we really appreciate it. And we are going to continue to bring you these things. And we actually have on Thursday, the February 3rd, we have a symposium on Query with Confidence with Isabel Sterling. And she actually is super cool. She's doing a real, she's telling you all these things about querying, query tracker, all these things, tools that you use to query and query letter tips, but also doing a deep dive into rejection.
Even better.
Because handling rejection is a definitely important skill set. So if you go,
there's a lot of it.
Yes. And sometimes, and just a little shop work for one second, we should send you this recording in a couple of days. But if for some reason you don't get it, sometimes Zoom doesn't give us your email address. So email, which is weird. So email symposium@pipelineartist.com and we'll send it to you. So thank you, everybody. And
thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
And have a great night. Thank you.
Lane. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's good to see your face.
I know, yours too. I can't wait to get back to LA.
Right? I'm ready.
I know, me too. Hey, thank you, everybody. Bye.
Symposium is brought to you by Pipeline Artists, a division of Pipeline Media Group. To learn more about upcoming live symposiums, visit symposium.pipelineartists.com and follow us on Twitter @PipelineArtists.